You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Betty's tea room again. No, you don't need to ask now. We've taken up residency. How are they going to get rid of us after tomorrow? I'm just going to be here all next week as well.
Oh, the door is big enough for us to get out. We've been out and about today, though, to be fair. We've all had little things on today. And we must mention last night, shouldn't we? We should start by mentioning our event last night at the Royal Hall. What a great occasion that was. We had Matt White, Daniel Freeb. I never mind Matt White. We had Daniel Freeb. Yeah. We had Ciro Scognamillo came and joined us for a bit, and there were 600 people in the audience, which is the biggest thing we've ever done. And it was Francois Tomaso, Lionel Burney and me and those other people. It was great, wasn't it?
It was great. I mean, Daniel, remarkable man, Daniel Freeb, isn't he? Comes to cover the World Championships and goes home before the elite road races at the weekend.
But I was there for the big night, which was, our show.
He was.
But, oh, really, good success. Smooth, I think everybody enjoyed it. I mean, at least we did. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing about Harrogate is it's quite a small place and it's full of cycling fans. So walking around today, I've met a lot of people who were there and they've all said very nice things and been very, very nice generally. And it does feel as if this town has been taken over by cycling and cycling fans. And that feeling is intensifying, isn't it? And I think today for the women's road race, the atmosphere and the crowds in the town centre were fantastic.
Yeah, I saw the penultimate passage and the one before that of the women's race down on the kind of the S Bend bit of the circuit where they come sweeping down the hill and then do a hard left and then sweep up, and then a few minutes later they come down on the main run into the bottom of the final climb. And so there's a real bottleneck of fans there, very, very busy, 6-7 deep on that corner, a real kind of amphitheater of sound there. And the finishing straight as well was deeply packed crowds, a lot of noise, and it does feel like the World Championships has really started this afternoon.
And it was, yeah, it's also very good mannered, very, you know, nice. I mean, people are sometimes, you know, sports crowds can be a little bit aggressive, or you have a feeling of there is some tension there, but not at all here. It's like a big garden party in a way, and it's very nice.
Yeah, and it's great. We were remarking earlier in the week, it didn't feel like the overseas fans had really arrived en masse yet, but they really have now, hearing lots of European accents around. Saw a group of about 8 or 10, I assume, Dutch people, although I don't want to judge by appearances, in sort of orange, head-to-toe orange policemen's outfits with orange policemen's helmets. And the Belgians are here, the Norwegians are here.
And Slovakians, it's amazing. Mm. Yeah, what Peter Sagan has obviously done to that country. You see a lot of Slovakian fans here. The power of a personality and a multiple winner like that, I suppose.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our title sponsor. And we spent a bit of time today, Rose Manley and I, at the Rafa pop-up. We sort of went around the town to various places to watch the race. That was for an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, which will come out next week. And it focused entirely on the women's road race today as it unfolded. We've got quite a lot of interviews in there as well, but we'll hear a couple of interviews in this episode too. We're also later on going to talk about the controversy around the under 23 road race and disqualification of the in inverted commas winner. That was happening as we prepared for our show last night, so it didn't feature in last night's podcast, but we'll talk about that a bit later on. And we'll also get some news on the World Championships in 2023 in Scotland, which will be the first ever World Cycling Championships, including track, road and mountain biking. But today the big event was obviously the women's road race, and well, what a performance from Annemiek van Vleuten.
Amazing. Earlier in the week, she underperformed in the time trial. She's the time trial champion from the last 2 years, of course, and was expecting to go well. She said in her post-race press conference or interviews after the time trial that she felt the power numbers were there, but just didn't happen for her in the time trial. But she was a slight seed of doubt whether she could get the right kind of performance level for the road race, but was still confident that, you know, the training numbers she was doing wouldn't just evaporate. And well, 104 kilometers out in front on her own, a real commanding performance, winning by 2 minutes 15 ahead of Anna van der Breggen, her teammate, of course, and Amanda Spratt was just behind for Australia, taking the bronze. And really, then the time gaps were, everyone else was, you know, another minute back to Chloe Dygert-Owen and another minute back to Eliza Longo-Borghini and then another minute back to what was left of the bunch. And the course really did some damage once Van Vleuten went away on her own. We were talking over the course of the week and as well in our event last night about team tactics when you've got one team that is stronger than everybody else. And Matt White made a very good point about Quickstep's tactics in the classics. He said when they signed Matteo Trentin for Mitchelton Scott, one of the first things he asked him was how does a tactical plan get decided for the big cobbled classics, Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix? And Trentin apparently said, well, it's basically a race to get in the first big break. And it was similar here. That was the thing that was going through my mind once Van Vleuten was away, was that really she was kind of racing against her other teammates to be the first one up the road, knowing that the team spirit and the organisation and the kind of the trust and faith between them, each of them, is enough that they would then do everything they could to defend and assist. And really, that's what happened. You wonder, would Anna van der Breggen have been strong enough? Would Marianne Vos have been strong enough to do the same kind of thing? I suspect they might have had a go, no?
Van der Breggen went clear with 39 kilometres to go last year, and that was hailed at the time as extraordinary. In a way, this is going to sound weird, but in a way it was more extraordinary because today there was quite a strange set of circumstances conspiring to sort of help Van Vleuten. Now, we also heard from Matt White last night about what a trainer she is, and she trains with the Mitchelton Scott men and pretty much holds her own and you know, puts in big long rides in particular. She's a very good time trialist, and I think one thing she would know is that she's capable of riding 100 kilometres on her own pretty hard. She probably does it in training all the time. So when she got clear with that distance left, I don't think she was thinking, I'm going to ride my own to the finish here at all. We're going to hear from her in a moment actually saying exactly that. But behind her, there was a chasing group with Anna van der Breggen in it. Now, She was like an anchor for that group that, you know, those riders in that group with designs and winning would have had in the back of their minds and the front of their minds all the time that van der Breggen was there and she was a massive danger. That would have had a bearing on how the race played out, not to take away anything at all from what was an extraordinary and amazing performance.
Maybe that's the point, you know, about her disappointment in the time trial came from the fact that actually over 20, 30 Ks, maybe, you know, Van der Breggen on the day Chloe Dygert were better on this type of distance, but over 100 Ks, probably Van Vleuten is the only one capable of doing that. But and also Anna van der Breggen in the press conference said once Van Vleuten had gone, she said, well, I'm happy with silver because that's the highest medal I could go for, meaning, you know, implying that once Van Vleuten was ahead, there was no chasing her. And as you said, confirms that actually the race, I mean, the tactics within the Dutch team was the first out, you know, is going for it, you know. And Van Vleuten took a chance. And, well, as she will say, later, but and she said it again. I mean, she didn't think in the first place that she was going all the way. She maintained a gap, and she said, you know, she really thought that the chasing group would come across and then maybe it would be a Van der Breggen chance, but it never happened. So as extraordinary as the performance may look, she actually paced herself very well, because for 40 Ks, the gap was about 45, 50 seconds, and so she was not at her limits, and that's when she realized that, you know, they were not coming back behind her, and maybe some of them had already settled for medals instead of for the win, that she really gave it a whole, and then only Van Vleuten, I think, on of the field, is capable of holding such a long effort.
So we hear from Annemiek van Vleuten. Here she is, speaking at the finish, talking about that extraordinary 104-kilometre solo attack. And the moment she worried that Chloe Dygert, who had counterattacked behind, might get back up to her.
What did you think when you got away on your own with 104 kilometres to go? And did you think, this is it, this is the race? Or what was going through your head at that point?
Oh, that I felt super good today. And that it would be maybe really stupid to ruin my legs with a solo. But then my national coach told me, like, no, continue for Anna van den Breggen behind the ideal situation, and they're not chasing hard, so go for it. Yeah, and then you get inspired to go for it. And I felt like I give it a go. But also I played a bit smart, not to give everything in that first part and just take time on the climbs.
Were you getting a lot of information about the time gap?
The motor was pretty good, also in telling me what's happening behind and that if they were chasing or chasing hard or who were there. So that was good, because yeah, we don't have communication, so you need to know what's happening behind. If they were chasing me full gas, then it would be stupid to continue.
Could you ever imagine though that you would stay out in front on your own the whole race?
No, with 100 kilometers solo, that I couldn't believe that would be possible. Only with, I felt super good today. And I still had the power all the time. So that gave me confidence that it could be maybe possible. Because I saw some numbers with my power meter. I felt like, oh, this will be hard for the people in the back if they produce this power also. They will not come close a lot. I think with 15k to go, when Dygert, first she tried to come across, and then the back was 145, and then I got a bit nervous. But when I saw again 210, I felt like maybe this really crazy day can be finished off for me. That was the plan, together with Anna, and then create maybe a small group to put pressure on, because it would be stupid for the Dutchies not to use that opportunity to make the race hard. And then the plan was to see after the descent, see the situation, and then we have contact with the national coach what to do. The most special win after last year Innsbruck, the disappointment I had there, that I couldn't celebrate my world title time trial at all after breaking my knee there. And also on a course that I felt like that was my opportunity to be world champion. I was crying that was my only opportunity to be world champion. And then finish your off season so shitty, that makes this title even more special that I can really enjoy now. So on Wednesday I give myself one day to be a bit sad and have one night of bad sleep, and then I didn't want to analyze it, just I postponed that with 1 week with my coach. We had a 3.5 hour ride actually the day after on the road course, and I felt like I was thinking, like, I had a thought, oh shit, I have to take out my World Championships clothes out of my closet. And that made me really sad on Wednesday, and then I thought, like, no, there's maybe an opportunity Saturday that the clothes can still be there. And I can. They will be still there. I don't have the moment that I have to take them out.
So that was Annemiek van Vleuten, resplendent in her rainbow jersey. One of the few things missing for her. And, you know, she crashed last year in Innsbruck. She crashed in Rio at the Olympic Games. This is the one that has eluded her. She's 36, and her trajectory has been upward the last few years. She's one of these riders who's just got better and better in her 30s. And today was, well, as she said, the greatest performance of her career.
A big credit to her performance today was when riders tried to chase. You know, Chloe Dygert went for it, going for a medal, and she bonked. Literally, there's nothing else to say. I mean, the last lap for the young American, you know, the new time trial world champion, was hell. I mean, and she, I saw her at the finish, she was kind of limping around, you know, looking absolutely exhausted. So, you know, when the world, the new time trial world champion, you know, trying to go behind you, you know, finishes the race limping in pain and effort, it shows the value. And even, you know, a very experienced and good time trialist like Italian Longo Borghini, she also, you know, tried to go for it, and not to mention Lizzie Magnus, I mean, no, local
hero,
Lizzie Dignan, who was probably the only one to really chase in a chasing group at first.
Exactly. I think she was, you know, one of, and the fact that she started attacking that group told you perhaps how effective the group was in really committing to the chase. And I felt watching it, there were riders either on a bad day or not, you know, soft tapping, really. They weren't And again, it's partly because of the distance remaining, the toughness of the circuit, but also the fact that Anna van der Breggen's there. And, you know, she's getting an armchair ride. And I asked Anna van der Breggen, and we'll hear this interview in the Cycling Podcast Femina next week, about her impressions in that group where she was obviously not contributing, whether she felt that they were committed to the chase, and she said no. I mean, one of the really interesting things about today's race is there's been a lot of focus on the finishing circuit, but the decisive moment came on the Lofthouse climb, and that, as I discovered speaking to a few riders that finished, wasn't actually a surprise. They had all identified it as a really hard climb, even that early into the race, and that was a climb where Annemiek van Vleuten went clear. And it was a climb where a lot of riders came unstuck. And one of them was one of the fancied riders going into today's race. Even some people's outside favourite for the rainbow jersey, Kasia Nowiadoma, the Polish rider who rides for Canyon SRAM. And, you know, I spoke to her at the finish. Here's what she had to say.
Were you surprised the race broke up the way it did so early on?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't surprised that the breakaway went away at that climb. I was more surprised with my shape or with my legs, because they were not responding to me at all. It was so weird because I even couldn't get this lactate acid in my legs. I was just so empty, and it's so weird because I have no idea why, because I've been feeling so good before the start, and I don't know if the last 2 days I was just like overthinking this race, and maybe I built this unnecessary stress level in my body, because I was just so empty that even I could not get out of the saddle, and that's not my style, it's not normal for me, so I don't know why my body protested somehow. Maybe that's kind of a lesson, but it's a hard one. And yeah, it's just so weird. I mean, like, I can't blame anyone. It's just me and my legs that were not responding to me.
It must have been difficult because you must have known as well the riders in that front group, how difficult it was going to be to get them back.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of had that hope that everything will come back together. I knew that it might be difficult to catch Annemiek, but I still was like hoping for a medal position. Although everyone was riding hard, like the first group and in our group there, the teams were not really working smoothly, so many times we had those gaps of like just riding very slowly. But yeah, it's crazy, seriously, like, you know, coming here like hoping for a rainbow jersey because you feel so good in your body and you're confident, to like waking up feeling kind of off and like having a terrible day on the bike. It's weird because I don't know if like normal human beings can understand that, because like I don't know, because I even cannot understand that.
What do you make of Annemiek van Vleuten's performance? 104 kilometers on her own.
Right, exactly. Do I have to say something? It's incredible. Like, wow, I have no idea. I mean, like, it's mind-blowing, to be honest.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Cyclist Magazine, the stunning monthly magazine dedicated to the thrill of road cycling. Now, how would all of our podcast listeners like to get a 3 months trial subscription for just £5, plus a welcome gift from Muckoff? Richard, £5 for 3 months copies of Cyclist Magazine, I mean, that's not much more than some couple of inner tubes, is it? Plus, listeners will get a free Muckoff luxury shaving kit worth £29.98, and that includes luxury shaving cream and luxury aftershave balm. Richard, you're one of Cyclist Magazine's correspondents. What have you been writing about in the most recent issue?
Well, I contribute a monthly feature, Lionel, and the most recent one is about the World Championships here in Yorkshire, looking at this week's racing, but also looking at the future of major races here in Yorkshire, given that Guy Verity, who did so much to bring major events to Yorkshire, is no longer involved. I spoke to Andy Hindley, the chief executive of Yorkshire 19. Some people locally, particularly critics of Guy Verity, keen for the organisation that is Yorkshire 19 to exist beyond the World Championships. As it stands, they'll be wound up after the Championships, but some people would like them as an independent organisation to take over major cycle races here. But I was speaking to Andy Hindley about the comparison with the Grand Départ of the Tour de France here in 2014, and there were some things that I knew but hadn't really thought about. I mean, the Grand Départ in 2014, obviously 22 teams and 198 riders. The World Championships, 80 countries taking part, 1,400 riders. And one of the interesting things that Andy Hindley told me was that the entourages with some of the national teams are enormous. You know, staff on a pro team, maybe 25 to 35 people. With the Italian team, 150 staff with their national team here in Yorkshire, which is quite extraordinary. So yeah, looking at, you know, the impact Gary Verity in particular had, and the fact that he's not here, having done, as I say, so much to bring these championships to Yorkshire, what will it mean for major events in Yorkshire in the future?
The Italian team support staff, even bigger than the Cycling Podcast team here in Yorkshire. Well, Richard, you write a monthly column for Cyclist Magazine, as you say, but the magazine features much more than just your esteemed work. Each issue is packed with the best ride routes, the latest bikes, the must-have kit, and some exclusive with the biggest names and brands in the cycling world, all illustrated with fantastic photography as well. So if you would like to sign up for a trial subscription to Cyclist Magazine, that's 3 months. Monthly issues for £5 with no obligation. You can cancel at the end of the 3 months, but you could, of course, take advantage of the print and digital bundle that they offer. Just visit cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast and you can get your 3 issues for just £5 plus the free muck-off shaving bundle. So that's cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast for 3 issues of Cyclist Magazine for just a £5 plus the muck-off shaving bundle.
Well, we heard before the break there from Kasia Nevyedoma, and as I say, lots more reaction to and reporting on the women's road race in the Cycling Podcast Femina, which goes out starting next week, probably Tuesday morning, I would think. The other big story today in Harrogate has been the under 23 road race and the disqualification last night of Niels Eckhoff, the Dutch rider who was the winner. It later emerged that he had crashed with about 130 kilometres to go. He dislocated his shoulder, popped it back in, had a bike replacement, and then sat behind the Dutch car on his way back up to the bunch. Now, when the UCI jury examined this later on, after the finish, he was disqualified and lost his gold medal. It's really split opinion, I think. It's quite telling that a lot of professional riders have been on social media calling it an outrage, while a lot of fans have been outraged. In other words, the professional riders, a lot of them are saying that drafting in the convoy or behind cars is how riders get back up after a crash or a mechanical. And there's certainly a clear distinction between that and, for example, holding on to the car, which, if you remember, Vincenzo Nibali did at the Vuelta a few years ago, Romain Bardet did at Pyrenees, and that resulted in instant disqualification. So there are two questions, I suppose. One is, if he committed this offence, should he not have been disqualified at the time if it was deemed to be a disqualifiable offence? And second, is this not the sort of thing that happens in a race every day? And especially if it happens at 130 kilometres to go, does it actually really have a material effect on the outcome of the race?
Well, Richard, Eckhoff was world champion for 15 minutes, wasn't he? And then the jury made their decision and Samuele Battistella was upgraded from silver to gold, which also meant that Thomas Pidcock moved up from fourth to third and the bronze medal position. And he said he came to win the race. There was no real joy in moving up a position, particularly after the disqualification. Now, the rules are quite muddy, really. They allow quite a lot of leeway. They place quite a lot of subjective assessment in the hands of the commissaires. But the main distinction is that you are allowed to move up through the whole convoy of cars, going from bumper to bumper, moving up, using the drafting effect to regain your place in the peloton. But you are not allowed to sit on the back of one car, which is not in the convoy, and regain lost time that way, technically. But we know, don't we, that in all races, riders get back on, they get back up to the peloton, and they use the cars, you know, whether it's the old sticky bottle or sitting on the bumper, they use the slipstream to regain the position they were in at the time they had the mechanical or the crash. And it's the unwritten, it's the grey areas, and it comes down to this subjective interpretation. The issue, I suspect, is that then Eekhoff went on and won the race. That is what has created the situation. I was trying to think about it the other way around. Say Eekhoff had gone to the podium, got the rainbow jersey and won the race, and then this footage emerged at 9 or 10 o'clock last night, and everyone was going, well, hang on a minute, the winner sat on the bumper of a car in open road for 2 minutes plus to get back up. The public opinion may well have swung slightly the other way, so I can see both sides. So I really don't know what the right answer was, other than to say that he still had to pedal his bike quickly. It's not a free ride riding like that.
It's not like holding on.
It's not
really
a free ride.
Like
it is hard. It's intense. It's into the red. Okay, the car can slow down a little bit just to...
it's up to the commissars on the race as well, and they can't advise everywhere, and he was off the back at the time because he'd crashed, let's not forget. Where they deem the vehicles to be providing unfair assistance, they can order the vehicles to stop at the side of the road, and that's what sometimes happens. They can't, as I say, see everything. But it would have been much better if an offence had been deemed to be committed and seen at the time that the action had been taken at the time.
I've let you talk like you know, most of the cycling fans and the cycling pros have for the past day, but my opinion on this, I mean, it's a general one. I mean, I made it a rule for myself to think the rule is the rule, and refereeing in sport in general. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I was a runner, and my coach, my trainer, and all the guys, you know, the staff around in my club said that the number one rule of sport is the referee is always right. I think that's something we should get, you know, kind of respect, because it's kind of spreading not only to cycling but in all fields of society. Justice is now always criticized, and any justice decisions or legal decision is kind of disputed. The social networks have changed the way the things are perceived. Without Twitter and without, you know, videos, you know, being shown live all over the internet for the past 10 years, the old rules, I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, the decision might have been disputed for like an hour, but then nobody would have the footage of the incident, and it would have settled down. These days, everybody thinks is both a rider, a team manager, a referee, and a commissaire. So when I read and I sympathize what the most professional rider think about it, they imply, let's face it, they imply that all UCI commissaires are a bunch of idiots who don't know what they're doing. So if that's the case, I'll tell you what. I've said repeatedly that the riders do not take an important enough role in the you know, management of their own sport. So if they want to change the rules, do it. You know, stand for it and say the rules for drafting are not clear enough. They are not good enough. We should change it. But do it. Do something. You know, instead of always complaining that we don't know what the rules are, it's complicated and blah blah blah. Second thing. I read a lot about the decision, saying, oh, the decision came too far. The guy should have been put, taken out of the race straight away. Why did it take so long to... I mean, the commissaires who decide on this sort of decision, they're in a car in the race, you know, and they have to go to the finish to make a decision, have a meeting to decide what was going on.
And view the footage.
And view the footage. So they can't all of a sudden stop, you know, in the middle of the road while the race is going on and you know, have a little meeting, make a decision, then go back in the race. It's not feasible. So, I mean, the dispute is a little bit silly. So once again, I tend to, even if sometimes it's wrong, I think that once a judge makes a decision, once a referee makes a decision, once there's a fair trial and someone is judged, we should not, never criticize this. I mean, that's the basic rules of society and the basic rules of sports, you know.
I agree with the principle entirely. I agree with the principle. But I think we have to then rethink road racing, because how road racing is organized now with a convoy is that the convoy... In other words, the vehicles that follow the race offer a second chance to a rider who has some misfortune. So a mechanical or a crash, how do people think that rider gets back to the race? They don't get back riding on their own to a bunch that's racing along. That would be impossible. So the way that a rider comes back, and how many riders have won races having suffered a mechanical or a crash? Quite a few. So this is a part of bike racing. It's like an insurance policy. What I think is that that hasn't... Now, the rules might state in black and white, and but as you say, Lionel, they're a bit vague and a bit opaque, and they're usually it's a fine rather than a disqualification for this kind of thing. Holding on is a different matter, but sitting behind a vehicle is in that grey area, I think, and it could have been a fine rather than a disqualification. This was a very harsh punishment. I totally agree with the point you're making, Francois, but there has to be consistency in applying the rules, and we have to also, you know, understand that this is how road racing has worked for decades, that the convoy is effectively part of the race, and it offers a way back into the race for somebody who's suffered a misfortune. That might be right or wrong, but it's the way it is.
Maybe it's the same thing in football. You know, sometimes refereeing at the World Cup is different from what the refereeing is in a domestic league or even in a Champions League. Maybe UCI is trying to set an example, and that's what happened there. I didn't watch the 10 minutes of... Who actually did watch the 10 minutes of drafting?
Two minutes. Yeah, I did.
Well, it's very difficult from these 2 minutes and a half to make a real decision. Am I more competent than a commissaire to decide whether it's the rules or not? And are professional riders, do they know what the spirit of the rules are better than the UCI commissaire? I don't know. That's a good valid point. But if that's the case, then ask, you know, like in the old days of rugby or football, ask one rider in the bunch to be the commissaire that day. You know,
Fabian Cancellara is retired, unfortunately.
Come out of retirement to referee the race. On the professional riders coming out in support of EKOF, I understand that probably best of all the aspects of this story, because there, but for the grace of God, goes every rider who's ever had a problem.
Of course, I know they all have been in this position, yeah. So of course they will defend. I mean, have you ever heard a football player say the referees are great, that's the best profession on earth, we love them? Have you ever heard a tennis player thinks the lines judges are right? But, I mean, it's part of sport, you know. Yeah. They're the enemy.
People are criticizing the rule, and the rules are, you know, it's referred to in various places in the UCI's regulations on the operation of road racing. The rules are not clear. There's not a hard and fast rule. And the reason there isn't a hard and fast rule is because if, Francois, they said, okay, you're allowed to draft behind a car for 1 minute, all that would happen is that everyone would be using their 1 minute time, yeah. And how many multiples of 1 minute per race? And, oh, you can have 5 1-minute drafts. I mean, you would end up changing the culture of road racing so completely. What we have is not perfect, and this was a really imperfect situation. But what the alternative you're saying is that the guy crashed.
Do you know what the answer is?
Had his shoulder out, but then is not entitled to rejoin the race in the place that
he was
in.
Do you know what the answer is to this? Do away with the convoy. In this, you know, in these times of climate change and so on, and consider the number of vehicles following
but
a bike
race. Commissaires on a bike.
Well, there are commissaires on motorbikes as well. But have, you know, three or four neutral service cars in the race and get rid of the team cars, because those team cars are obviously going to help their riders if they can, and yeah, if they think they can get away with
lovely,
it. That,
lovely idea, Richard. But
it's
you
a very
know,
good point.
I mean, come on, look. That means that you crash and you're on the ground for 45 seconds to a minute, and your race is not far from over.
But that's the kind of the point I'm making. So to argue the other point is to say that that rider gets back thanks to assistance from the vehicles following
the
race.
To go back to the physical effort, and obviously everyone could look at a Strava file and go, oh, this is ridiculous, he's travelling at 64 kilometres an hour or whatever on, you know, you can't ride that fast without drafting. It's not, it's still up there in the heart rate zone,
of course,
and it's a physical effort.
But the point is, so is the convoy there to provide support and mechanical assistance and other support to the riders, or is it there to help riders back into the race? And are we acknowledging that it is there,
well,
partly to help riders back into the race?
Tacitly, we're accepting that that's what they do.
Yeah, and that's what the Dutch team did yesterday.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, in an age when you know, some guys are you know advocating forbidding power meters and ear and radios and stuff. I mean, the idea of giving up the convoy altogether, like, it looks quite appealing to me, to be honest.
Well, it's quite strange.
Single speed bikes. Let's get back to single speed bikes. No gears. Yeah. Hang on.
Bikes,
but look,
run.
I actually think the point I made at the very beginning, the order that this emerged into the public domain is actually quite critical to the way it's been received by a lot of people. If it had happened the other way around, I suspect, obviously can't prove this, but I suspect the feeling of public opinion would have been swayed the other way. Oh, you know, he's won the medal, he's got the jersey, poor old the Italian rider who cheated out of a gold medal because this guy's ridden on the wheel of the bumper of the car for 2 minutes.
And the second important point is had it not crashed but simply punctured, everybody would have supported the ban, you know? The dramatic, the emotional thing about he crashed, you know, he dislocated his shoulder. I mean, it made it so you know romantic. Then all of a sudden, the commissar came to spoil a great story.
Well, so yeah, he was a victim rather than the Italian rider.
Quite. But it is possible to say that he broke the rules and the spirit of the rules, and yet deserved to win the race. Those two things do not necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. And lastly, on the point of precedent, this sets a really awkward and uncomfortable precedent because, yeah, I mean, what happens if tomorrow one of the big stars does something similar? Maybe not for 2 minutes, but for 1:20. Will there be an outcry because of a similar set of circumstances? And then we see one of the big names disqualified after the fact. I mean, you can't apply it only to the under-23 race and say, well, we've applied the rules really well and fairly here, and then turn a blind eye in the elite race. I mean, that is an absolute nonsense.
I think he himself made the best reply to that. He said he was very disappointed. But what we know now, I mean, what we saw in this race is that this young guy is very talented and he'll win other races. So, and that'll be the best answer he can give.
So I think, in summary, we have concluded that he both deserved to be world champion and he deserved to be disqualified. Case closed.
But perhaps the final word, chap, should be the two riders most affected by this, Eckhoff and Battistella, who both reacted with graciousness to what happened and I think didn't perhaps get as worked up and upset about it as some other people on the sidelines. Eckhoff said he'll be back, and Battistella was expressed sort of disappointment that he hadn't won it by being first across the line. Maybe that should be the final word on it. It won't be.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thanks very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Very nice to have Cameron Matthews there from Science and Sport, our event last night. Thanks for coming, Cameron. And you can get 25% off your Science Support products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Now, when I was in the Zwift draft house earlier on today...
Oh, the draft house. I mean, this is stepping into controversial territory, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah. Well, drafting... we've established drafting is not allowed.
Oh, dear.
But drafting on the Zwift... You might have a Zwift drafting application. Could be fun as well.
Anyway, it was good in there.
The convoy.
It was good in there, and I'm going to go back. But I bumped into a couple of people very involved in the 2023 World Championships, which are coming to Scotland, and it'll be the first ever World Cycling Championships, which includes track, road and mountain bike, all the Olympic disciplines, the year before the next Olympics. And the idea is every 4 years the World Championships, which will be in August between the Tour and the Vuelta, will be the Olympic disciplines, road, mountain bike and track. So Glasgow and Scotland in 2023 will be the first running of these, and it should be really interesting. So I spoke to the two men responsible for organising these championships in the Zwift Draft House.
Well, I bumped into Paul Bush and Robbie Clyde from Event Scotland at the Zwift Draft House. You are the people responsible for bringing the World Championships to Scotland in 2023, which will be the first time we've had multidisciplinary, well, for a few years anyway, track, mountain bike, road. Tell me, how did it come about?
Well, it came out of the vision that the president had a couple of years ago, and we met him at Sport Accord in the Far East. literally over breakfast, and it was as simple as that. It was like, do you fancy doing it? And we said yes, and then it took us a year to get the package together with government and funders. But for me, it's probably one of the most exciting propositions in world sport, probably in the last 20 or 30 years, and what better place to bring it than Scotland, the perfect stage.
You would imagine that the track cycling will be in the Chris Hoy Velodrome in Glasgow. It's billed as a Scotland bid, but do you see it being centred in Glasgow, or will it be generally all around the country?
Yeah, obviously we've got the built venues that we need, like the Velodrome, to Chris Hoy Velodrome, and the BMX Centre that was built last year for the European Championships. So we don't actually need to build any new costly venues. But then we've got the likes of Fort William that's hosted mountain bike World Cups for the last 17 years. We've got other mountain bike venues such as Glentress and Peebles and the Tweed Valley. And then for road races, well, we've got the whole of Scotland to work from. So, yeah, we don't need to invest in any infrastructure. We've got a lot to work from and 3.5-4 years to plan.
I mean, do you know yourself, or do you have a shortlist in your head of possible venues for the road events?
I think we've got a long list of great venues. Obviously, we want to showcase Scotland, but it will be finishing in Glasgow. So the traditional World Championship loops will finish in Glasgow. But again, we're looking at a more challenging loop in Glasgow to what we've had in European Championships and Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, I know you were in Innsbruck as well, Paul. What have you learned from those championships and here in Harrogate?
Well, I think they've done a really good job in Yorkshire. It's a wonderful county to have cycle races. I mean, the topography and the terrain is really challenging. It looks like Harrogate have really embraced the event, all the shops and the food and beverage places. People of Harrogate are used to cycling in terms of Tour de France and Tour de Yorkshire. So I think they've done a great job, but you can always learn lessons, you know, and we'll take that back and study it over the next 3 years before we deliver in August 2023.
More laps of a finishing circuit, please. What will be the duration of the championship?
It will span two weekends, and I mean, that's the work we're currently looking at present. So we're having those detailed discussions with broadcasters and the UCI, and I guess in the next couple of years that will get locked down much more. But obviously, there's always some fluidity around the programme. But having two weekends as bookends will be really important.
So there's quite a lot to pack in there. Are there going to be clashes? Are you going to have track events going on at the same time as mountain bike or road?
No, the plan is that we will split everything out. And I guess from a TV broadcast perspective, if you imagine a Olympic type coverage, multi-sport, moving from a mountain bike qualifier in the morning to a artistic cycling in the afternoon, track finals at night, that type of full 8 to 10 hour TV broadcast over that week and a half period, that's the complicated factor that we need to build into this. But it's going to provide us with some challenges, but will ultimately be a great showcase of cycling, particularly from a broadcast perspective.
Well, that was interesting, Richard.
Well, we don't really know what to expect, do we? No. I mean, I'm curious about the timetabling of it.
Back in the 80s, Francois, you'll probably remember this, when you covered the World Road Racing Championships in Chambéry, they had the track championships on the outdoor track in Lyon maybe the week before. It was kind of both, they used to be both together then. So it's kind of the UCI going back and reinventing.
And adding mountain biking.
And adding mountain biking, yes. All of our attention now turns to the final race of the weekend, doesn't it? The men's elite road race. It starts at 8:40 in the morning. Now, today I was up at the, I was going to say hotel, where the Australian and Great Britain teams are staying, but it's not a hotel. It is, in fact, a police treatment centre. And I gather that police officers, serving police officers, pay a small subscription. And then this centre, residential centre, offers support and a bit of a sanctuary for some R&R for serving and retired police officers if they're physically injured or if they have post-traumatic stress. And it was quite a strange atmosphere there, because it felt a bit like a private hospital. It's not quite a hotel.
What were you doing there, Lionel?
I was meeting a member of the Australian cycling team for a potential future project. Can't say any more than that.
Sounds intriguing.
Anyway.
In a hospital.
Anyway, while I was there, I learned that the early start, 8:40 tomorrow, means that breakfast time is 5:30 for the riders tomorrow. That means quite a short night's sleep. Well, obviously they'll go to bed earlier, won't they? But an early start.
Possibly.
An early start and bad weather beckons for the riders tomorrow. Could be one of those epic races. And before we go, let's hear from someone who's riding for the Ireland team, Conor Dunn, kept a diary for us at the Tour of Britain, which we put out for Friends of the Podcast last week. Really entertaining listen. We put it out in two parts. He's become quite the podcaster, hasn't he?
Sending something else. We can't stop him, can we? Can't shut him up.
He sent us a little dispatch. He's, of course, riding here, I imagine. They have high hopes for Sam Bennett.
I speak to someone today who thinks Sam Bennett is a really good outside bet.
On that finish, if it comes down to a little group, I would say, and if he's over the line first, he'll be world champion.
Only if he's not then subsequently disqualified for sitting behind his car.
Anyway, let's hear a little dispatch from Conor Dunn from Harrogate.
Hey everyone, Conor Dunn here. Reporting from Harrogate the day before the World Championships in Yorkshire. Pretty chuffed to be here again. This is my fourth World, so I can't believe how that time's gone, to be honest. But it's always such an honour to be at the World Championships and have the special national jersey on, the Irish jersey in my case. So, yeah, it's a huge honour to be here. It's been a good build-up, actually, for me. I've had a lot of racing, finishing off the Tour of Britain 2 weeks ago. Actually, my recovery after Tour of Britain... wasn't that great. I was pretty tired and got sick. So that whole week, really, I was just struggling to get healthy again and really not doing much training, just easy rides, trying to recover. And I was supposed to race in Belgium at the weekend, but unfortunately, I was just not right to race still. So it was a real long recovery. But in the end, I actually started to come good once I got healthy. And I've done a seven-hour ride on Tuesday and a couple of intense rides too, and felt the legs come really, really good. These last days seem to have been having a little bit of the odd bit of bad luck. I got stung by a wasp on the head right on the temple in the middle of a VO2 max effort. And then yesterday, actually, I walked into a door frame really hard. I was looking at my phone and just walked straight into a door frame. And I had to lie down on the floor. I thought I'd give myself a concussion. But I think I've hit my head so many times on door frames now that I've kind of gone past that point now. Thankfully, I had a bit of a headache yesterday. But today I've been feeling better. All to play for tomorrow. I'm on the start line, which is the main thing. Managed to see a good bit of the course. Managed to see the finishing circuits. And Dan Martin, my roommate, he's done the first 190K. So he's been telling me a bit about what he thinks. The general consensus among most people is it's going to be a proper epic day. Proper epic. Like in my three worlds, the worlds are always epic, but I think this one with the weather was due to rain a lot. I think this could be a real corker of a race. It sounds pretty hard, and the first 190K, the big loop, sounds pretty tough. A lot of wind and rain and smaller roads, bigger roads, and depending on how it's raced, I think we'll arrive on the circuits and everyone's going to be pretty shot by the time we even arrive on the circuits. And I think for anyone who's been watching the races previously, the under 23s, the juniors and the women who might have seen the course, I think it's actually a bit harder than it looks on the TV. Like there's a lot of quite technical corners, maybe I'd say three or four real kind of key corners on the circuit. And if you're out of position on these corners, you're going to be spending a lot of energy sprinting out of them further back down the line, even as far as like 40 or 50 guys back. I think it's going to be hurting the legs. So if a big group arrives on this circuit, I think it's going to be pretty tough. I think it's a similar circuit to the Richmond Worlds, I reckon. I can see a similar scenario happening. I think with the weather conditions being worse than it was at the Richmond Worlds, I think the selections are going to be made even earlier. Then the last 175K is just going to be full-on slugfest. Got a strong team here with Ireland. We've got six riders and... Sam Bennett and Dan Martin in good form, so we've got a few cards to play and a lot of Irish support out on the road. So this kind of I feel we're going in as kind of a little bit of an underdog sort of mentality maybe, and see what we can do. Be a big day, but yeah, so looking forward to it. Soak up the atmosphere a bit as well if we can, and just get stuck here and empty the tanks. Worlds is mega. Everyone's half cut on the side of the road, going bonkers. So it's always a good one. Everyone's so motivated, and just give it our best. Get stuck in. Ciao for now. Hopefully, all the best for tomorrow for everyone in the race, and the winds of luck will be with us, we hope. Thanks.
I know you wanted to finish the today's podcast on this on this interview, which was quite interesting. But we've talked for the past couple of days about a lot of favorites for tomorrow's race, and we never mentioned once Julien Alaphilippe. I think that being the Frenchman in the team, I have to say a few things. There was actually a very interesting piece in L'Equipe 2 days ago about Alaphilippe and Arrogate. In many ways, it was for. I mean, he's always been successful when he rode in Britain, apparently, Julien Alaphilippe, even in cross country. And there was, and Arrogate was the start of a great friendship between Julien Alaphilippe and Mark Cavendish, because when Cavendish crashed, and they were in the same team at the time, which was Quickstep, not the Koenig at the time, when actually Cavendish came back to racing, they shared rooms for a number of small races, and a real friendship took, you know, started between them, and Alaphilippe said repeatedly, I mean, Cavendish really, you know, was behind him, encouraged him, to sent him texts to, you know, cheer him up, and there's a huge respect between the two of them, and it started from there. And Alaphilippe said really to see how humble, and you know, actually Cavendish in some races like Tour de l'Ain, you know, went down to fetch, you know, pick up the bidons for Julien Alaphilippe when he was in the leader role. And so, well, I discovered that the really, apparently, the strong, you know, a friendly link between the two, and it started, well, indirectly in Harrogate. That was that little thing on Alaphilippe.
Apparently we've been saying Harrogate wrong, and a listener, a friend of the podcast who was on our bike ride the other day, gave us the correct pronunciation. Let's just hear what it is.
Arrogate.
So apparently, Harrogate.
I said it correctly on stage in the Royal Hall, Harrogate, and everyone cheered in Arrogate.
Okay, I mean, great.
What's this become now?
Okay, really? So listen, we'll be back tomorrow with the final podcast from Arrogate.
It's going to be a 30-minute special, Daniel Freeb's assessment of afternoon tea.
Okay, thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, guys.